Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality and further beyond. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today by John Harris, award-winning Guardian journalist and also maker of the BAFTA-nominated Anywhere But Westminster video series. John, thanks a million for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
It's always nice to be here.
Yes, and actually, I haven't talked to you since pre-pandemic, which was a long, long time ago. A lot of water under the bridge since then.
Round about the time of the Russian Revolution, as I recall. Yes, there's a lot happened since then. Two world wars.
It really does seem like people have described it in terms of COVID having the potential implications of a war. And of course, you're in your own war there. With Brexit, in terms of speaking of wars and all sorts of utter, omni shambles is the word. What's your sense of where it's at now?
Well, as we speak tonight, the drumbeat of No Deal is getting very loud again. I mean, that's happened throughout the Brexit process, certainly for the last couple of years, once the negotiations started in earnest. But a lot of people in the know seem to be suggesting that No Deal is now the overwhelming likelihood.
Yeah.
You're seeing signs of chaos at the ports. You know, Honda is suspending production at its big car factory in Swindon, not far from where I live. There's talk of the supermarkets having to take kind of special measures to keep food supply going. So all of that's sort of around. But we all know what No Deal is going to mean. It's going to have a profound economic impact. I would imagine that a fair few businesses are going to go to the wall. And then that sits in the midst of the biggest recession. I don't know why I'm laughing. This is gallows humor, but it sits in the midst of the worst recession for 300 years. And this pandemic and its very long tail, which is already, you know, a matter of huge economic significance, you know, mostly a very, very negative way. So all the talk is that January here, and I dare say because, unfortunately, Ireland, Southern Ireland is, you know, you're chained to this mad person still stampeding around. This is going to have profound impacts for you as well. So January is going to be a pretty horrible month as far as I can tell. It's the most, I said to my partner earlier on, it's a miracle the postal comes through the door every morning. I have a sense of that at the moment, really, that the crises are now piling up.
And it seems, though, would it not be an utter political failure for Johnson himself if there's a no deal? I don't understand why he would allow it in that sense.
On the face of it, it would be, given that right from the get-go, when he became the leader of the Conservative Party, as we both know, he was talking in terms of an oven-ready deal. I mean, all the rhetoric throughout, really, particularly from him, has been about the supposed easiness of securing a deal and why he was the man to do it and all the rest of it. So on the face of it, you would think that a failure to get a deal would have sort of profound political implications, but I don't think we'd sort of live in that world anymore. I mean, the other thing is, you know, I'm paid to be invested in Brexit and to pay close attention to what's going on. But my sense talking to the public, so to speak, is that not unreasonably, really. The whole thing has become so arcane and sort of terminally repetitive and boring that most people have tuned out. And therefore, I'm not sure Boris Johnson will be effectively held to account in that sense, because people have long since sort of lost track of where we're up to and where we're meant to be going. Now, maybe a different question if there's very little food in the supermarkets and if the economy crashes. We'll have to see. But then there again, you know, the noises from the government in the last sort of 5 or 6 months, repeatedly I've heard this thing that they've said, well, any of the negative economic consequences of no deal will sort of be buried in the negative economic consequences of the pandemic, and it'll be hard to separate the two. And maybe in the most cynical way, that's part of their calculation. But of course, yeah, from any objective viewpoint, it's a howling political failure if that's what happens. I mean, as much as anything, they've had 4 years to sort this out.
And where do you see it going then in terms of that, like, what do you actually see is going to happen? You think we actually will have a no deal? And do you think what's going to, it's just going to be a mess then?
Well, all the talk is that the positions of the EU and the UK are irreconcilable. And I suppose that's fundamentally reducible to the fact that the UK still seems essentially to want most of the benefits of being in the EU without actually being part of it. So there are all these questions about regulatory alignment, state aid is flying around, questions about fisheries, which don't ask me about those, I have no idea. I mean, God bless Britain's fishermen, but it is quite odd that this sort of very peripheral, very small share of our national income, this industry, is suddenly at the centre of the political conversation. The whole thing's really, really surreal. I only know as much as you. You know, all the political editors that I follow on Twitter and so on, and all the people that I read, and the government itself tonight. I mean, Boris Johnson has said there is a strong, he said the word strong twice, possibility of what he calls an Australian type trading arrangement, which of course just means no deal. So I take it very, very seriously. And the other point is, even if there is a deal of some description, we're still going to be in the realm of vast lorry parks and businesses having to fill in huge amounts of paperwork and the absurdity of businesses in Northern Ireland having to fill in paperwork to export to England, Wales or Scotland and all this stuff about a border down the Irish Sea and all of that. We're still there. So either outcome is terrible. We're just confronting it finally. Up to now, it's been like the phony war, Brexit, and here we are. It's about to happen.
And what's his game plan?
You'd have to ask him. I can't account for the mental world of Boris Johnson. Give me a break.
But like, in terms of where did they see this going? Where did they want to get to?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The logic of their position throughout, I think, has always been antithetical to the prospect of getting a deal. Because, as I said earlier, that, you know, Boris Johnson himself, one of the quotations with which he's most indelibly associated is this idea about, you know, wanting your cake and eating. It's kind of where they've been throughout. I also think, I'm writing a column partly about this for Monday's paper. I also think what this tells you, or what this kind of speaks to, is what happened to the Conservative Party after Mrs. Thatcher, which is that it's a very sort of restless, zealous, ideological to the point of being crazed sort of organization now. I mean, historically, the Conservative Party, before Mrs. Thatcher came along, was seen as being a sort of cautious, measured voice of the ruling class and the establishment, right? But it didn't take chances.
Yeah.
It's hard to think, I mean, even if you take this beyond the Conservative Party, it's hard to think in any democratic country of a government that would purposely imperil the economic well-being. I mean, you know, when I say economic well-being, you know, I say that in a qualified sense.
Yeah.
Insofar as Britain is riven with inequality and poverty and all the rest of it, right? There are, as you know, a lot of my work is about large swathes of the country where it doesn't feel like there's much well-being or prosperity around. But nonetheless, you know, clearly this government is playing fast and loose, you know, to even get this close to a no deal, whether or not it happens, is sort of unprecedented. And the way that they sell it or have sold it so far is on the basis of sovereignty, these very high idealistic sort of abstract notions, you know. And I don't think I've ever seen that happen in a democracy, for a government to come around the corner and say, well, we're going to take a massive hit here, folks, and it's going to be terrible, but we're doing this for the sake of abstract principles A, B, and C. I mean, Fidel Castro used to talk in those terms, right? Mm. The politics of revolutionaries are often like that, but it's a very weird thing to see it happen in a democracy and also happen thanks to the Conservative Party. But that's what happened to them after Thatcher. It became a party of sort of ideological mania. And once they'd sort of privatised everything they could get their hands on and freed up the City of London and all the rest of it, Europe became the dragon that they thought, increasing numbers of them thought, they had to slay. So this is a 40-year story. The question then, of course, being, well, once they've slain the European dragon as they see it, I mean, of course they haven't, but in a very parochial British context, what's the project then? What is conservatism anymore? And I don't think even they know the answer to that any more than the American Republicans do.
And it is interesting because I was thinking of that there, like the significance for Johnson of Trump's loss? And is it significant? And that question of where Johnson is going and where that Conservative Party is going, you know, beyond Brexit. And is it almost in a way they have become so removed from the reality, which is, as you describe, you know, huge inequalities. And in a way, the parallels with Trump are similar there, that it's almost like they are absolutely disconnected from what's going on. And it's to try and distract from that reality that they play these games and they have made politics into, you know, a panto.
I think there's a lot of truth to that in the sense that for a short period that seemed to work as well. I mean, let's not forget, coming up to a year to the day, isn't it, since Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party won that election and won it pretty resoundingly on the basis of, as you say, the sort of politics of, well, theatre to some extent, but also the promise of getting Brexit done. So it worked for them for a while. The question of their associations with Trump, I'm not sure about that. Insofar as I think Johnson and some of his people are aware of inequality and the fact that the country is so imbalanced and kind of somewhere in themselves think they ought to do something about it. Right. Whereas Trump was just all theatre, right?
Mm.
Nothing structural in American society changed. I mean, he hoovered up the votes of people in the Midwest whose towns had died and all the rest of it, but he hasn't done anything about that, really. I think Johnson thinks he's going to do something about it, but the point is that Brexit is such a convulsive, economically damaging event that even if that were true, where are they going to get the money to do it? And that kind of partly explains why this phrase you hear all the time in British politics, levelling up, which is this idea that the government can get to work on the imbalance between the north and the south of England chiefly. Well, so far they've earmarked £4 billion for it out of the foreign aid budget, whereas any reasonable estimate tells you they've got to spend at least £1 trillion, I think, over 25 years. Clearly, I mean, that's like turning around the east of Germany after reunification. It's an astonishing job of work if you're serious about doing it. I don't think they are, but that doesn't mean that they're not sort of mindful of it. Conservative politics remains very, very complicated, but I think they must be worried. I mean, I hear on the grapevine that, you know, it's not like Johnson's rushing into this with glee. Just the logic of his party's position and what his own MPs will and won't find acceptable has sort of painted them into a corner.
And it's worth thinking then, I'm struck by and always impressed by your, you know, ongoing work about highlighting, you know, those inequalities and injustices, you know, at the heart of, you know, excluded and locked out Britain, that, you know, as you said yourself, like that they're willing to take this risk of piling more economic, you know, hardship on an already, you know, suffering country. That it seems very, very high risk.
It does seem very, very high risk. I mean, as you know, the great sort of political feat that the Tories pulled off at the last election, FEAT, was winning dozens of these seats that up until that election, you know, recently were considered sort of solidly Labour seats, you know, fantastically loyal to the Labour Party, and the so-called red wall in large part fell, right? Now, all of those places, by dint of being in a very fragile economic position, are very susceptible to the downsides of Brexit, you know. If the only jobs in town are in, let alone the pandemic, I mean, this is where the sort of double crisis comes into play.
Yeah.
So if you've got former coalfields or places where there used to be steelworks, they're the sort of places we're talking about. Most of what they've had to kind of survive on for the last 20 or 30 years is retail, right? And then along came logistics to kind of add to that a little bit. But the pandemic has really put retail, obviously, in a terrible, terrible spot here and all over the world, right? So if you go to so-called red wall places, you'll notice that, you know, everywhere's high streets in a mess, but they're in a really, really bad way. And then along is going to come, it looks like, a no-deal Brexit. And even in the case of a Brexit with a deal, which is going to have pretty calamitous economic effects. And it's always poor places that feel those things first. The only question is, as I said earlier, you know, politics is a strange thing now. And whether or not that necessarily means that it's all over for the Tories in those places. Will they be held to blame for that? I don't know is the answer to that question.
Yeah.
That's a really, really tough one to call. In the same way that you and I from the outside would have thought that Donald Trump would have just got thumped, right? I mean, he hasn't done anything for the kind of hard-pressed areas that voted for him. He was a clown of a president who ended up denying a pandemic and suggesting people inject themselves with bleach.
Yeah.
And yet he got in excess of 70 million votes, right? Mm. There's something about modern politics which means that those sort of chains of responsibility and accountability don't work in the way that they used to. And I think that might be part of the government's calculation. And the other thing is that might work in a very crude way, right? So if Britain does leave the EU without a deal, maybe the Tories and the tabloid papers will just say it's all the fault of the French and the Germans. Hoist up the flag, we stand alone. I've always thought there's a sort of reasonable possibility of that happening. But it just becomes, you know, another great sort of blow in the flag-waving culture war.
And that's very, very possible. And I think it is something, you know, when you look at Trump and you look at that, you know, that he got so many votes. And, of course, the part of the reason is that so many people are excluded, you know, and have lost out and have been failed by what they would see as progressive or anyway, like the Democratic Party in the US, and would see them have not having changed anything, that they're just, as you know, have described yourself, it's the same in the UK, are just completely lost in that sense. They feel unrepresented by anybody.
Yeah.
And therefore, if someone is shouting, going, you know, well, I'll represent you and I'll stand up, and then point the finger at the immigrants, or point the finger at Europe, or point the finger somewhere else. It's almost like it's a politics of distraction.
Yeah, but it's a politics of belonging and I'm on your side and all those things. And even if they don't sort of speak to people's direct economic interests, people feel those things very strongly. I suppose as identification with class and all that, and organized labor and heavy industry, all those other those sort of traditional sources of identity, as they've waned, you know, most of us feel the need to belong to something or another. And then in the most sort of cynical way, if you're not careful, nation becomes the thing that you can sort of sell to people. And that's a large part of the story of Brexit, and it may yet be a large part of the way this plays out. Having said that, it doesn't get much more direct and visceral as no food in the shops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I guess the answer then, what that comes down to, is what we're about to find out, aren't we? We're about to find out whether we live in this ridiculous, surreal, postmodern universe where the chains of accountability have broken down, right? And where as long as particular political forces play the right cultural cards, they can get away with anything, right? Which was Donald Trump's calculation. Famously, he said, I could stand on the street and shoot people on Fifth Avenue and they still vote for me. I mean, he knew, right, that if you're not careful, that's where this sort of internet age politics goes, right? Or are we still in a world where at least the most basic forms of accountability still count for something? And I suspect it's probably the former. There are already signs. I mean, I'm no fan of opinion polling, but there have been opinion polls published recently that suggest that in those red wall seats we talked about earlier, there is a bit of a switch going on, and the Labour Party's back in the lead and all of that. And I think a lot of that is because this has been such a shambles, and also because the government's made such a balls of the pandemic. That's the other thing we haven't talked about.
Mm.
So I know you're going to ask me about this in a minute, but going out into the world, as I did the other week, and talking to people sort of, I mean, I don't live in London, so I live in the, I like to think that I live in the real world too, right? But going out into the real world.
I like that phrase. You went out into the world last week.
Into the world. Well, only because of the pandemic, I very rarely leave my little town. Do you know what I mean? So it was a miracle to be on a motorway, apart from anything else. But
I think
people feel instinctively here, and this again is a singularly British story, people know that we've got one of the highest, if not the highest, death toll in Europe. It looks like the pandemic will have had the most profound effect on our economy. So at least you get one or the other. The idea being that, you know, you trade, this is a terrible thing to say, but if you get a high death rate, perhaps then at least you've avoided the worst of it economically. But we've managed to do both things together. The government's messaging has been terrible throughout, you know. one of the reasons we're in the mess that we're in again now is because they in a very slapdash way, sort of loosened the restrictions over the summer. I think people know all that. You do meet the odd person who says, I think Boris Johnson's done a reasonable job on that. But I think people know that they're in the midst of something pretty unpleasant and the government's incompetence has got a lot to do with it. So maybe that'll feed into what happens in January as well. If I was a Tory, I'd be nervous. Totally. There's no way that I think I'll just hitch up the flag and everything's going to be all right. They must be pretty worried about this. It's just that, as I said earlier, you know, that they got on this train 4 years ago and we all knew that sooner or later it was going to end up either at or very close to this station. And so it's proved, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll wait to see now what happens in the coming days and weeks and months, and we'll come back to that. So just to...
If I still have electricity and broadband at that point, Rory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, well, I'll send you a message via pigeon post.
I'll swim over to you.
That's a good idea. It's a good idea.
What I was going to say was...
I'll meet you in the Cumbrian area. You'll be glowing with all the radioactivity by that point. But
yeah,
right.
Yeah. I'll be nice and warmed up by it, all right. Yeah. I probably get a bit of it, actually, because I do swim in the Irish Sea, you know, in Dublin Port. So I probably get a little bit of it.
A little bit of it does you good, Rory.
Yeah, we'll see about that, won't we? I'm like a test case. The pandemic, and, you know, you wrote, and I was struck by it, and I'm not, you know, we have our experience here as well. It's, you know, you wrote about, you know, you talk about the mental health impact, you talk about the loneliness, you know, you talk about, you know, the impact of deprivation. You also talk about something that I, you know, there needs to be a lot more looked into, is this kind of, I think actually it's going to grow the gap in inequality, because you have sort of that middle class, which you describe, who are in many ways just able to continue on. Yes, they're within there, they can work from home, or they're, you know, continuing on in their jobs. And then you have this devastation, as you described, in the retail sector in particular, in low paid, low wage, people renting, for example, who are building up rent arrears. This is in terms of Ireland, what's happened, that I think there's a real, you know, young people, a huge, you know, when we look at the kind of fallout, inequality is going to grow. And how have you seen sort of the impact on the ground from what you saw?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was obvious from the word go, was that this would, in all sorts of ways, COVID was going to be a sort of great magnifier. So whatever social problems you had going into this, which is the way, incidentally, that these great crises, be they pandemics or wars, usually play out, right? Is that any social or economic weaknesses that you have going into one of these crises will then turn critical in the midst of it, right? And all over the world, that's happened. So that's the last part of the story in the States, much worse in the States even than here, right?
Yeah,
because of the absence of a reliable welfare state. I'm aware, because one of the legacies of us having met all those years ago is that half of my Twitter feed is Irish housing people. So I'm aware every day on Twitter that the housing crisis in Ireland's getting worse, right? And it's clearly being fed by the pandemic, right? And that the sort of urgency of that debate about housing as a basic right, the pandemic has definitely accelerated that, right? That's clear. So all those things have happened here. The thing that really sort of set my teeth on edge early on was the way that sort of class played out culturally, so that on the broadcast media and the print media, lockdown was being characterized in this very sort of whimsical way, you know, like, oh, isn't it a scream, you know, baking cakes and learning to speak German and playing rounders in the garden and all that, you know.
Making sourdough bread.
And everyone's working from home, aren't they? And, oh, isn't it? What a novelty it is, having all these Zoom meetings.
Yeah. And I have now, to see my kids during the day.
Yeah. And I teach them history. Now, I am, you know, I'm from that background myself, and that was broadly my experience. But I was very acutely aware from the get-go that wasn't the entirety of the experience. And in point of fact, that was probably a sort of minority experience, because an inordinate number of people had to carry on working out in the world, right? Also, if you're living in anything approaching kind of confined conditions, and that means most people, incidentally, you know, most people in cities don't have gardens to speak of and all that, you know, that this is going to be an incredibly difficult experience. Finding
time. Of
course,
the housing crisis of overcrowding in particular exacerbated.
Overcrowding. And then so you had all of that going on. So the demands of the restrictions, which were, you know, for a long time, of stay in your home, right, were impossible. And then on top of that, almost, you know, to add insult to injury, it turned out that poverty, overcrowded housing, also if you were from a black and minority ethnic background, that statistically made you more vulnerable to developing serious illness if you caught the pandemic. Anyone who had a public-facing job, if you were a security guard, taxi driver, if you worked in retail, whatever it was, you know, clearly you were in harm's way in a way that someone who was home working wasn't. And you reach the point where, as Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, said to me when I interviewed him about 3 or 4 weeks ago, he said, look, the thing people don't understand is that in large swathes of the north of England and the south of England and everywhere else, truth be told, lockdown didn't really happen for a lot of people, right? They were all at work. They had to get on with it. If they were working in the more insecure parts of the economy, they had to get out and work in order to get paid, in order to live, right? And that kind of bifurcation of the experience of it, I still don't think has sunk in terms of the way that this is covered. And now you have this prospect of this very, I mean, it's not a prospect, it's a lived reality now, right? But it's going to get worse. The economic crisis this has created, which again is going to affect all those places disproportionately. And then you've got I'll trowel on the misery, right? You've got a generational aspect. I think the unemployment rate among 18 to 24s here now is 13%, which is high, right? When we were in Manchester the other week reporting, I met 3 people under 25 who'd been unemployed for 6 months in the course of about 10 minutes. It was obvious that was a really, really big thing. So God knows, you know, that's why Brexit is so terrifying. I do have this sense that by February or March, you know, all the consequences of this crisis are going to become vividly clear, just as this other crisis becomes vividly clear as well.
And the question then becomes, you know, at a really macro level, you know, pandemics, wars herald historically huge change and significant change and societal transformative change, the NHS, public housing, fascism. So the question is, you know, where are we at in that? Is there possibilities of progressive possibilities? I think in Ireland, I see, you know, there is progressive possibilities of a right to housing, of, you know, an expansion of our public health system. Now we are starting from in many ways, a worse base than you were with the NHS, that we haven't had an NHS here. But there's definitely, you see, potential. But how do you see it from your perspective over there? What do you see? What historical moment are we in?
It's not always necessarily true that you get these social leap forwards after these sort of mass experienced events. I mean, there was a bit of it after the First World War, but not anything like what happened in 45. Mm. And in point of fact, we had the Great Depression after the First World War. So, you know, whatever happened, it didn't sort of insulate people to any meaningful extent in that context.
You had the Great Depression and then you had the war.
And then you had the war, right? So I think that things have happened here which definitely put those issues of inequality and poverty in particular much closer to the political foreground than they've been in years.
Mm.
So one of the sort of signature, not even a political event, like a cultural event in the last 4 or 5 months, has been the footballer Marcus Rashford's campaigning about so-called holiday hunger and the fact he had the government on the run, really, on that, you know. And that was suddenly an issue in the culture, you know. So the tabloid papers had to talk about it. Tory politicians had to talk about it. This question, which, you know, you can read the guy, you know, for the last 10 years, you can pick up the Guardian or the Daily Mirror any day of the week and it'll tell you, look, the people in this country are going hungry, you know. But it hadn't, terrifyingly, it hadn't broken it in the culture. I think that's there now. I think there are questions about the esteem we sort of grant to people in certain jobs and whether that's reflected in how they're paid.
Mm.
So pay of nurses, for example, because of the pandemic, I think that's a salient issue in a way that perhaps it wasn't up to now. I think it would be politically impossible for the government to return to the sort of austerity we had from 2010 onwards. It doesn't mean that we won't get dribs and drabs of it. They won't be quite harmful, but I don't think they'll try anything on that scale. So things have shifted. Whether we're in a position to have the watershed conversation I'd like us to have so as a society, which is, I mean, it seems to me from this pandemic, it's obvious we can't go on like this. I'm sure you have that sense about Ireland as well, you know. Mm-hmm. it's intolerable because there'll be another one of these things.
Yeah.
And we all know the effects climate change is going to have. You know, I mean, it's not like we're going to be suddenly we're all going to get the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, and you know, everything's going to be okay. So, I think we do need a meaningful, very rich conversation about the fact we can't go on like this and what kind of society we want to live in. I think in the first instance, it'll happen in the culture before it happens in politics, which is almost the reason that Jeremy Corbyn didn't happen for all sorts of reasons, a lot of which were down to the fact that strategically and tactically they weren't very good and they walked into all sorts of traps of their own making and all the rest of it. But as much as anything else, I don't think that the culture was aligned to have that conversation. It kind of was a bit in 2017, but then that went right. I would like to think now that irrespective of what politicians do, the culture is now sort of aligned in a direction to start talking about some of those kind of social fundamentals and the fact we can't go on like this. And then the question then is, well, which politicians are going to respond to it? And I think the problem with the Labour Party at the moment, although it seems to be doing quite well in the opinion polls and so on, is it seems very resistant. I think it feels it got burned by the Corbyn experience. And it seems very reluctant to have that kind of sweeping, big, ambitious conversation about what kind of society we want to live in. And it's going to have to do that sooner or later, otherwise it doesn't deserve to be in the game.
And the question, of course, that is really the fundamental question. Will the Labour Party be in a position and will it engender this conversation and nurture the conversation and, you know, excite people in the way that Corbyn did, you know? And obviously, as you say, that's interesting that the culture wasn't aligned in that sense. And that, you know, there's a potential, you know, is the current leadership, it will most likely be still in place. Do you see?
I worry that it feels like that. You know, the Labour, I have no illusions in the Labour Party. So, you know, I mean, I vote for it, right? And I think I might still be a member of it, but I don't expect much of it. And I never have, you know, and it seems to sort of bounce between being so sort of radical and full of possibility that it scares people. And then in the wake of that, then sort of, you know, going hedgehog and retreating and feeling that it can't possibly talk about anything like that, which I fear is sort of where we are now.
Mm.
And it very rarely seems to find a way in between those things, which is how you take power and how you achieve sort of lasting change, which it hasn't been able to do very often. I think in all likelihood, it'll be quite late cottoning on to this, but that's fine. You know, I think if you're going to achieve, I mean, 45 is a good example of this. So the great social breakthrough that happened in this country then, that was after decades of work in between the wars. Outside, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it happened outside the bounds of the Labour Party. And it wasn't about changing the culture and about how people lived and the trade union movement and the nonconformist church and all of that. And then, you know, by the time you came to the war and the effect that had on people, you know, the wave was sort of irresistible. Now, Something like that has to happen now. We have thriving civil society. You know, I mean, the internet, for all its downsides, has enabled people to organise and acquire collective voice in a way that was quite hard to achieve in the past. You know, so, and also the other thing, no doubt, has happened where you are, right, is that in the early stages of the pandemic, you had all this great explosion of mutual aid and community self-help. And it's very fashionable to think all that's dwindled away, and I'm not sure it's wholly dwindled away. I think the experience of doing that still sits with people. So there are lots of interesting possibilities here. I don't feel that bleak, you know. It's just that we've got got a hell of a lot of crisis to get out of the way first. You know?
It is. It's funny you say you don't feel that bleak, but for the first 25 minutes of talking to you, the bleakness oozed from your
Gramsci thing? Pessimism of the spirit, optimism of the will, or the other way
that's
around?
That's it, pessimism of the intellect, yeah.
Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. Now, that's kind of it. You have to think yourself in an optimistic space. Of course you do.
Yeah. But I think you're right, though, in the sense that, and we did see it here in Ireland and have seen it, that explosion of you know, the initial response to the pandemic was, you know, in many ways wonderful. You know, people out helping each other, the whole notion of community and living enlivened, and even like governments, they're like, here we had, you know, eviction, ban on evictions put in place, freeze on rents, things they said they could never do, you know, put in place, funding pumped into the public health system, you know, welfare supports given, these things. And they can't take those back in that way. Of course, they're already removing them. But in that sense, people will have seen that they happened. People will have seen what they did. And so that question is, you know, people's eyes are opened, expectations are raised, and going, well, if you did that then, why can't we do it again?
And why there's lots of test cases there, right? So the government put up, I mean, it was not a very generous change, but it put up universal credit, the main benefit here, by £20 a week in the midst of the first lockdown. And they now plan to take that back. Right now, the question is, are they going to feel at liberty to do that, or have things shifted to the point that they won't? That's a really good question. This is a very, very interesting question about the furlough, right? The fact the government's been prepared to pay 80% of people's wages, yeah, who effectively have been laid off, right?
Yeah.
Now, can you go back to a world in which if you fall foul of the labour market or your employer, suddenly, you know, you're only paid, you're not even paid enough to live on, because that's the reality of the so-called welfare system here, right? That's another interesting question. Yeah. So all of those things are in play, but I don't think we can have that. We probably can't have that conversation meaningfully till the spring. I'm sitting here gazing at this horrible, dark, wet evening, and you know, and every time I switch on the TV, it tells me that the bottom's about to fall out of everything. So you'll forgive me if optimism still feels like a rather distant prospect. But we went there absolutely. For a moment. We went there for a moment, Rory.
We did. And do you know what? We'll call it quits there. That'll do. I'll hang on to that till I talk to you again. But before you go, you had promised me an album of the year. And you also did a really interesting piece on John Lennon.
That's not out yet. That's out in 4 or 5 days. So Mojo, the music magazine that I write for occasionally, because it's 40 years since John Lennon was murdered, I wrote a piece for them about really the aftermath of John Lennon's murder. This, are you old enough to remember this, Rory? I don't know whether you are.
No. I remember it, but I'm early 40s, so you know.
So I was 10 when that happened. So that happened 40 years ago. I've just written that, but my albums of the year are two albums by the same artist. There's an artist called Salt, S-A-U-L-T.
Yeah.
One's called Rise, the other's called Black Ears, although they're both formally officially titled Untitled. And they very much chime with the Black Lives Matter moment in a really brilliant, creative, imaginative way. They're both like sort of song cycles about the Black British and Black American experience. And they're made as proper albums. And the amazing thing is no one really knows who these people are. They haven't got a Twitter feed or a Wikipedia page. They've not done a single interview. They've just put out these masterpieces, these two albums, and they're brilliant. And it's quite nice as well to hear sort of social, political, relevant music, which isn't a pain in the arse.
Great.
You listen to it first as music, and it so happens, right, that the more you listen to it, you suddenly realize how relevant it is. But it's brilliant. Yeah. So I would heartily recommend your listeners go out and listen to those two albums. They're both on Spotify, which means Salt will get the princely sum of about 0.0001 cents every time they play it. But there you go. Right. That's the way of the world.
Yeah, my recommendation is tell you where I am at in my stage of my life. I was saying to you earlier that it's probably have you got Alexa? Have you? God forbid.
Yes.
Yeah, it breaks my heart every time we have to engage with it. But anyway, the kids chat to Santa Claus on it, and
oh, that's good.
And if you ask Alexa, you know, how many days to Christmas, she'll tell you, and then she'll say, "Do you want to hear from Santa Claus?" And Santa will come in. And then it went a step further. Do you want to hear the song that Santa has made? Sure, yeah. So it's Santa and Mince Pie, some insane song about Santa and Mince Pie.
Oh, well, I will give that a listen, Rory.
So that's my.
I would have thought, is he not singing, "Buy more stuff from Amazon, please"?
I'm sure somehow in it is probably subliminally there, but
you are being sold something. This is the world of Jeff Bezos we're talking about.
Exactly. But enough talking about him. Have you a book of the year?
Have I a book of the year? God, what a question. That came out this year. What have I read this year that was good?
There was a really good one written on housing in Ireland.
Oh, yes, I have got a book. Is that your book? Has your book come out this year?
Yeah. I'm only one.
Your book, of course, is in my top three. There's a brilliant book come out by a former Guardian columnist, friend of Michael, Madeline Bunting, which I think is just called Care, which is about the crisis in social care and about why care is important to us as human beings and about how to resolve the crisis in it and what an aging society means and all that. And I read that in 2 days flat. I thought initially it was going to be quite a sort of, what's the word? A kind of bleak read. And it's not like that at all. It's a tremendously hopeful human book. So that's the best political book I've read all year.
Great.
Madeline Bunting's book about care.
I'll encourage you. I read The Hopeful History of Humankind.
Wow. That may explain the tenor of tonight's conversation.
Thanks a million, John, for joining us today. It was really great to have you on, and we'll have you back again soon.
Right. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah.
I think my Anyway, go on. Tell me about the book about hope.
So the book, The Hopeful History of Humankind, really interesting. It's the same guy, his name has completely gone out of my mind there. He wrote a book about, I think, Utopia for Realists.
Rutger Bregman.
That's the guy. Yeah. Very interesting, I have to say now. It's a sweeping tome. It's taken me about 6 months to read it. But it's well worth the read. There's a lot of really interesting stuff, and it challenges the whole idea that we're this of the selfish gene idea. Like it really.
Okay, no, I'll have that. Just, that's good.
It's a really positive book, but also very interested about psychology and social psychology. But I was quite struck by it because I thought one thing that's come out of the pandemic, to me anyway, is that this whole a nail in the coffin for Thatcher's idea that there's no such thing as society.
Yeah,
we are all just individuals that I've never seen the conversations about, we're social animals, we're social beings, we need each other, we need human interaction. And I think that will actually leave a lasting impact.
Yeah, well, I will go along with that. I think that's true. There is no individualistic response to this, really, is there? Even the scenes of joy about the vaccine and all the rest of it. That has underlined all sorts of fascinating and brilliant things. I love the fact that the couple who developed the vaccine were Turkish immigrants to Germany.
It's great, isn't it?
On two counts, Mr. Farage, you're wrong. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, John, thanks so much for joining us on Reboot.
Thank you as ever for having me. It's a pleasure.
Wonderful to have you. We'll have you back again soon. And let's see what happens.
Please do. Yes, I'll speak to you in January.
Great. Have a great Christmas.
All right. Yeah. Take care, man.
Have a good break. Thanks, John. See you.
See you soon. Cheers, man.
See you,
Matt.
Great. As always, to have John Harris on from The Guardian. And as always, please become a patron. Sign up to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Support us to keep producing these podcasts. They cost to produce. We're an independent media surviving on your support. We know you're enjoying them. We know you're listening. Please do. Whatever you can, fiver, tenner, 20 euro a month, sign up. Go to Patreon. It's a good time. A good time to help us out. Keep us going. So thank you very much. I'll talk to you all soon.